have been four sessions this week, and first session we dealt with a kind of historical overview of the conflict, starting with recent history, 1948, the creation of Israel, the first Arab-Israeli war, and sort of bringing us up to the present with sort of memories that people had of different events during that time, but then looking at a much longer span of time, because I think part of the unique is a word that may be used too often, but quite special about the Arab-Israeli-Palestinian conflict is how much history there is behind it. Some people see the conflict as going back thousands of years. I don't think that's particularly true, but certainly the background of the conflict in terms of the history of the Jewish people, in terms of the interactions of Christianity and Judaism, in terms of Islam, that does go back. In terms of Arab history in the region, it goes back centuries and centuries. And we, in fact, started our chronology in 3,500 years before Christ. Maybe that's why the conflict's so hard to resolve. In part, it is. The second day, we looked at each of the main parties, that is the four Arab countries which border on Israel, Egypt, Lebanon, Jordan, and Syria, and the Palestinian people, and Israel, and looked at them in terms of their views about peace, both in terms of their interests in peace and the constraints on how they pursue peace. Obviously, the notion there is that all of the parties have interests in peace, but all of the parties have problems in how they get to peace. And for some, that's already a more complicated view of the conflict than we're used to, where in some cases, anyway, people believe that the reason there is no peace is because, quote, they don't want it. Depending on who you are, the they could be the Arabs, the Palestinians, or the Israelis. And if you go to the Middle East, you'll hear all three of those versions. And sometimes a mixture of all of them, and sometimes a kind of thing, well, none of them really want it, you know. Yesterday we looked at the question directly, is peace possible? And I tried to say some fairly basic, but I think important reasons why, reasons related to how people's views, both on the Arab side and the Israeli side, have changed over the years, and how their experiences of the sort of conflict after 40 years makes peace more possible today than it's been before. Today, toward the end of the hour, we're going to take a look at the United States' role in U.S. policy, but I'm very conscious and a little bit chagrined at how much talking I've done and how little time there's been for questions. So what I'd like to do in the first part of the hour, and I think this probably is maybe more appreciated by those of you who have come to other sessions than by those of you who came today for the first time, I'd like to simply begin by seeing what questions are on your mind. And whether you've been here to a session before or not, my guess is when it comes to this particular area of the world, Middle East and the Arab-Israeli-Palestinian conflict, if you don't have questions, you haven't been paying attention at all, I mean to the world, let alone to the sessions here. So what questions do people have? And let's get a number of them out first and then look at them before we turn to the question of the U.S. role, which I definitely want to turn to. Tom?
Is there an influence that is about to be exerted by the emerging former Soviet republics, Muslim republics, that border on this area to the north, and then Afghanistan also, which is having its problems?
These
peripheral new emerging powers on the north and eastern periphery of the Middle East. And what effect might they be having?
And you're talking, when you said Afghanistan, you mean Afghanistan's influence on this conflict, possibly?
On the conflict and on the pressures that might interrupt the process of finding peace.
Okay. For Afghanistan. Yes, another question. Go ahead, someone.
Yasser Arafat goes back to 1948 and talks about, of course, when the Israelis pushed out the Palestinians.
Right.
But does anyone ever talk about the Islamic nations that pushed out the Jews and confiscated their property in those years?
Okay.
I know it happened in at least one North African country.
So what about Jewish refugees, or Jews being pushed out, I'm going to say Jewish refugees from Arab countries. Okay, we have talked about what happened to Palestinians when Israel was created, you're right. You referred to Arafat talking about it, which he certainly does.
Yes.
When you look at the ultimate solutions here, it seems that we've got two choices. If they both see this land as theirs, one is that they both live in the same parcel of land and have a kind of democratic government or whatever, or they're going to have to partition the land.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a feeling that it's probably going to have to come down to partitioning the land.
Mm-hmm.
What do you sense if it comes to that? How's that going to work? I mean, do you think that's going to be palatable to your side?
Okay. Let's see, in one state or two, what I'm saying is Palestinians, Israelis, in one state or two, and then I'll put in parentheses partition, and how will it work, okay? Yes?
In Israeli politics, is there an important difference between the Ashkenazi and the Sephardic Jews?
Ashkenazi Jews, Israeli Jews, in these two broad categories, Ashkenazi Jews are Jews who came to Israel from Europe. And then you, what did you use for the second? Did you say
Sephardic?
Sephardic, yeah. I didn't know whether you used Oriental or Sephardic. Sephardic, or sometimes called Oriental Jews, are Jews who came to Israel from North Africa and the Middle East region, from Arab countries in the Middle East. And the question is, what's the differences or significant in terms of the conflict, I assume you're meaning, okay? Ashkenazi, Sephardic differences vis-a-vis conflict. Okay, next.
A kind of more personal question. Mm-hmm. When you're talking to your thoughtful Jewish friends,
mm-hmm.
Who you're close to,
mm-hmm.
What are the things that are most, it's hard to talk about this.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe some suggestions about just how to start and, I don't know.
Okay.
I think this helps to learn more, but any suggestions you have for your time talking?
Are you here next week?
Yeah.
You are?
Yeah.
Oh, it's interesting, because next week, this topic, we're really going to shift the focus. And the primary focus next week will not be on the Israelis and Arabs, Palestinians, but rather on Jews, Christians, and Muslims in the United States.
Oh, well, maybe
and both the opportunities to work together and also the challenges. And to some extent, I put the challenges with a capital letter and opportunities with a small letter.
Well, you may, if you want to delay that.
No. Because some people obviously won't be here. Christians talking with Jews. Let's see. What do we say? Sort of
suggestions.
Cautions, suggestions. How many people have had that experience? Talking with American Jews, as I assume all of you are Christians. So, a good half of you. How many of you have had the experience of talking with an Arab American about this issue and or an American Muslim who might be Arab American or not? Fewer? Two? Three? Good. Neat. Yes, other questions? All right, well, let's take a start at these. And on the first, I think as far as political influence of the emerging republics, except for Russia, which has, in a certain sense, assumed the mantle of the Soviet Union in the talks, although it's obviously a much thinner mantle than it was. I mean, there's even a joke that when the talks are held in Washington, there's a figure there representing Russia, but in a certain sense, he is someone standing in the hall while everything's going on around him, not really playing a very significant role at all. Now, that's probably somewhat an American-biased joke, although you hear it from Palestinians and Israelis, as well as Americans. So So, but Russia is still in the process, and you know, when it comes to certain junctures in the talks, there, at certain points, there has to be some kind of agreement between Russia and the United States. And in that sense, Russia still possibly has some influence, but it's really so preoccupied with other things, so much reduced in power and influence, that its significance is considerably reduced from what it was in Madrid. And even in Madrid, when there was still a Soviet Union, the Soviet Union was facing so many problems at that point that even in Madrid, Soviet influence was much less than U.S. influence in the process. Apart from Russia, I would say that the emerging republics have relatively little influence on the process. They are, they have interest, and the parties have interest in terms of opening up diplomatic and trade relations with them as they emerge. So in that sense, they figure more in the future of regional development and the way the Middle East as a region and the countries in it relate to the whole expanse of Western and Eastern Europe and all across Asia. They figure more in the long-range future in terms of economic development and trade patterns and so forth like that, and possible political ties and alliances, than they do in the peace process itself. Now, another way they figure in the process is in terms of the number of republics in the now dissolved Soviet Union who have large Muslim minorities or Muslim majorities. And of course, right now, most in public focus in this country, what's been happening in former Yugoslavia, and the way in which that is experienced in the Muslim world, or experienced by Muslims, never mind in the Muslim world, but Muslims here as well, as a horrifying example, but in a certain sense, an example that Muslims find themselves tragically not all that surprised by, that the world will let Muslims die in large numbers and without taking any decisive action. That, you know, if it came to Kuwait oil, the world, the U.S. in particular, is prepared to take decisive action. If it comes to a state, a democratic state, interestingly, Herzegovina, Bosnia-Herzegovina, where there's a large percentage of Muslims, majority of Muslims, the world is prepared to see that just destroyed and a large number of Muslims become refugees and killed and so forth and so on and so forth. And that has, and let me make it very specific. There's a Palestinian Christian who is a member of our board who lives in Syracuse and has been involved for 10 years in dialogue with American Jews about this issue, and is basically a person who very much believes in a compromise solution, a two-state solution, working with Jews for that. And I had a long conversation with him by phone, his name is David Shomar, just a couple weeks before coming out here, in which the most painful part of it, or most important thing that I got out of the conversation, was how much David, Palestinian American, Christian now, not even Muslim, is viewing the prospects for his people, the Palestinians, in light of what has happened in Bosnia. In other words, whereas before what happened in Bosnia, he might have had some more optimism about the peace process, about the U.S. willingness to be firm and tough and to help the parties reach a relatively fair compromise solution. In light of Bosnia, and in particular in light of how the U.S. has not responded forcefully to what's been happening in Bosnia, David is now seeing sort of the fate of his people, the Palestinians, in light of that. And obviously that's a very, very discouraging view, to say the least. It takes you to the pits. And I think that, I mean, that's not a, you know, that's not a role of government kind of influence, but it's a very important influence, both of those. The feeling Muslims have that the world, and particularly the West, is in a way blind and maybe even happy to see Muslims die. And then this other thing about how Palestinians are seeing their own fate in the light of U.S. inaction in regard to Bosnia. It's interesting that our committee, which has issued a call for Jews, Christians, and Muslims to come to Washington November 7 to 10 to encourage a more active and a fair U.S. role in the peace process, in the initial postcards that went out to people, we say that the peace process, the Middle East peace process, is in trouble, and that we believe, we remain committed to the idea that peace is possible, that it's necessary, and that failure in this peace process, or failure to help achieve peace in the Middle East, presents even more dangers because of what happened in Bosnia. In other words, in the wake of the Bosnia tragedy and Muslims' perceptions about what that part of why it's working the way it is in Bosnia, the idea that the U.S. would now fail in the Middle East to achieve a peace that would be fair to the Palestinians and fair to perceived as reasonably fair by Arabs and Muslims is even a more dangerous prospect in terms of how we will reap in the future reactions to that. Afghanistan, you know, yes.
Why is our government acting in that way?
Why is our government acting in regard to Bosnia?
Yeah, right.
There's no oil there. I mean, that's a very simple and not. You have to say that. Maybe you don't only say that, and I think it's fair to say that you have to say more than that. But if you don't say that, I think you've missed one big factor.
Yeah, is there
for
a
sure.
Factor that's,
well, look. I mean, it's interesting. One of the things I've thought about, and I haven't heard anybody talk about it, is as long as the Cold War was on, the prevailing sort of popular image was that there were no people over there. You know what I mean? You know, I mean, Sarajevo, Muslims, the Bosnian Serbs, different political tendencies, the Russian Orthodox Church. In other words, it was all, in a certain sense, a blur as long as the Cold War existed. That was one of the, it seems to me, that's one of the costs of the Cold War, that Soviet Union was sort of one thing. I mean, President Reagan called it evil empire. You know, I mean, as the President of the United States, referring to it in terms that almost make it a video game, you know? When it breaks down, it seems to me it takes time for people to begin to readjust to the fact that there are real people and cultures and national identities and ethnic groups emerging, and we have very little relationship to that. I just found this morning, partly because my wife was in the peacemaking thing, was class this morning, was talking about Bosnia, and I found a Time Life Books thing from, I think, I don't know, 1960, and it was on the Balkans. And I began to look through it, you know, and there were pictures of some of the towns that now we've heard with these horrendous references of, you know, massive rapes and massacres and all that. And these were pictures of these towns and cultural life there. And of course, the 1984 Sarajevo, the home of the Olympics, you know. And I thought how little really we have a sense, in part because of the Cold War, of the people there and the realities there and the different things there. So I don't know, that's another part of it. Another part of it is domestic issues are the thing, you know. You look at the elections, you look at the campaign speeches by President Bush and candidate Clinton, and you find very little attention to international issues. Very little. Almost a competition to pay attention less to them between the two candidates. Well, in that sort of atmosphere, which of course reflects what they think we want, and in a certain sense they're right, you know, I mean, I think it's quite a common popular attitude. Domestic issues now, turn your attention here, why are you paying so much attention over there, wherever over there is. In that sort of atmosphere, for the president to make a decision to send American troops, which might have been one of the options at some point, very, very sensitive issue. Not a lot of public support for it.
That's like the... As long as the Soviet Union remained in power, it was always popular to send vast numbers of our military to be stationed in other parts of the world.
Right.
This was a popular thing.
Right.
And now that this whole thing turned out to be nothing, really,
yes,
just a paper empire, we got egg on our face. We don't know what to do with our military power.
Well, and it's ironic that you know, for people who worked for so many years in the peace movement, who tried to, you know, get us to say we shouldn't be exercising so much military power abroad, we shouldn't be sending troops here and there. A lot of people in the peace movement were saying this. Now, in the case of Bosnia, at least there's a sense of being torn about that position, you know? I'm not saying what position. I'm saying in the peace movement today, there's a sense of being torn about what should we do in regard to Bosnia. Now, I don't necessarily think the answer is to send the Marines.
And then intervening as a Vietnam experience, too.
Well, of course, of course. And what I'm saying is that there's a certain irony in it, in terms of things that we work very hard for in one direction, then all of a sudden come around a little bit and begin to haunt us as whether, well, we do we have to, you know, maybe we have to in this case, yes.
And the United Nations has labeled it a civil war, and so there are certain protocols that can't take place. When it's a civil war, then they have to be invited in, and so they're on paper.
Yeah, see, I'm not, even that point goes a little bit beyond my depth about it in terms of how the United Nations officially labeled it a civil war. I'm not clear about that, but certainly another question or another reason for what's of the failure in Bosnia is it seems to me that we're at a point in world history where the potential role of the UN needs, a lot of people would agree, needs to be strengthened to deal with situations like this, but the commitments to strengthen it have not yet been made in time to deal with the Bosnia situation.
We don't even pay our dues.
Well, the United States, of course, that's one example of it, but it's bigger than that, too. I mean, a lot of countries have not yet made a decision, for instance, that there should be some kind of a standing UN peace force. Every time they do a peace force, they sort of have to recruit it ad hoc, you know? Now, maybe there's certain good things about that, but in terms of Bosnia, the fact that there's not a standing, there's not, you know, then you're sort of in a, particularly when you're dealing with military forces that have certain capabilities, there's nothing, you know, you're sort of always behind what might be needed to intervene effectively. Well, let's move on a little bit. I just one more word about Afghanistan. I mean, I think one of the things to remember about Afghanistan, which we, you know, I don't think most of us, including me, we don't pay too much attention to Afghanistan. Just the simple history of it, Afghanistan on the border of the Soviet Union, developments in Afghanistan which, and the Soviet Union has taken a view that it always wanted to have a regime in Kabul, in Afghanistan, that was not hostile to the Soviet Union, that sort of a thing. Very common to big powers. Soviet, U.S., anybody, you know, it's like Cuba. I mean, it's that sort of thing. You don't want a hostile regime. And when the Islamic movements were developing and challenging the government of Kabul, the Soviet Union intervenes. And what ensues then is a long war, quite long. I mean, what is 8, 10 years?
7, 8 years.
7, 8 years, with the U.S. providing aid to Islamic forces fighting the Kabul regime because the Kabul regime was a client of the Soviet Union. Well, who are the groups that are fighting the Kabul regime? There are a variety of Islamic groups, I mean Islamically led groups, including some Islamic groups that, you know, in some sense the U.S. Is very much opposed to in terms of a certain type of extremism. But we supported them because they were fighting the Soviet-backed Kabul regime. Well, it's interesting that some of those groups, which gained considerable strength during those years through assistance in part from the U.S. and the West, were groups that even recruited people to fight with them from outside of Afghanistan, from Egypt, from other Middle Eastern countries. And there's now some clear evidence of connection between some of those groups and some of the more radical militant Islamic groups in Egypt and other countries. Certainly in terms of the overall phenomena of Islamic political Islam and Islamic radicalism, the Afghanistan case, along with the Iran case, were clear cases where Islamic radicalism grew. And they grew in the one case because of a regime, the Shah of Iran, and of course closely allied with the United States right to the end, and in the case of Afghanistan, a regime closely allied to the Soviet Union. And not able to make certain changes that accommodated more basic needs that people had and more open societies and so forth. So here we are, you know, 10 years later, sort of reaping some of the whirlwind from that. What about Jewish refugees from Arab countries? Well, there's when we're talking about what happened in the mid-40s during the period of the creation of Israel, we already made reference to the fact that large numbers of Palestinians left their homes in Palestine for a variety of reasons. There has been, up until recently, there has been a tendency to have particularly in the Jewish community, but this is held also more broadly, a view that many Arabs who left by choice, or they they left with the idea that they would return because the Arab armies would get rid of Israel in short order in that war in 48. Now it's very clear, as more and more evidence has come out, including, by the way, Israeli scholarship of foreign ministry records, early records of the Israeli government, that in fact the Palestinians who fled for many reasons. They fled because, and the overriding reason was they fled because there was a war, which is the overriding reason why refugees usually flee, why people flee their homes. There was a war and they were threatened, and they were trying to get out of the way, and they fled. Some other reasons, they were pushed out. I mean, the evidence has come out now, and again, I say this partly because it's important, you know, in talking with American Jews, Jewish friends, that when references are made to Palestinians being forced out, to take note, you know, that if that came up in a conversation, that very credible Israeli scholars, historians and others now have written books and documented that from early Israeli records. And of course it's, you know, I mean, it's on one sense it's horrible, and another sense it's that's the way wars work. You know, that one army trying to deal with a population that's hostile, you try to get them out of the way so you feel like you have some security in that area. It's awful to the people, but that it's particularly somehow something that Jews do or Israelis, no, I mean, that's the way it works. And what was amazing up until now was that to a certain extent in the Jewish community particularly, there was a kind of a belief in this idea that none of that was done. None of that kind of thing was done. Well, it was done. So they were forced out of certain areas. Another reason, some sold land in the earlier period before the war. They sold land or had land sold from out from underneath them. That's a lot of the land was owned by absentee landlords, Arab absentee, Palestinian absentee landlords, or Lebanese, and they sold the land to Jews who were buying it for the sake of building this Jewish homeland. But the people who actually worked the land, lived on the land, were poorer, not necessarily poor, but poorer Palestinians. They were farmers. And so land got sold, and that was another reason people fled. The war, being forced out, some did flee in a sort of strategic way, that is, they thought, well, let's get out of here now, and as soon as our armies defeat the Jews, then we'll come back. So with the illusion, and there were some, of course, Arab broadcasts, we're not saying we're going to lose, you know, they were saying we're going to win. And so there was a kind of a propaganda that also encouraged Palestinians in a certain sense to leave, and then they would come back soon. So that's sort of the story of the Palestinian refugees. Some stayed, but a lot, 300,000-400,000 stayed. 300,000-500,000 fled to Lebanon, to Jordan, some to Egypt, and then some who had the means beyond that to other countries. Jewish refugees from Arab countries. At the time of the creation of Israel, there were many, I don't know the exact number, I don't have it at my fingertips, if you do, you could say it, but certainly scores of tens of thousands in various Arab countries. Jews who lived in Syria, who lived in Egypt, not so many in Jordan, who lived in Iraq, who lived in Iran, who lived in North Africa, in Algeria, in Tunisia, in Morocco, and who had lived there for centuries. Some of them having gotten there coming out of the Middle East from way back, early times, after the destruction of the temple, others having gotten there coming out of Spain and Europe in response or under the threat of the Inquisition. And in fact, you know, many Jews who fled, who found themselves in Morocco and North Africa and in other places in the Middle East, including all the way to Turkey, had fled in the 15th century, 1492, Columbus, 1492 was also the Inquisition, they fled from Spain. This is why, by the way, they have the name Sephardic Jews, related to having come from Spanish sources. And so there are large numbers of Jews living in all these Arab countries. Well, as the nationalist struggle developed in Palestine between Arab nationalism and in particular its Palestinian nationalist version and Zionism during the 20s, 30s, 40s, and of course Arab states as they emerged and Arab leaders as they emerged supportive of the Palestinian side of that struggle, what happened to the Jews in those Arab countries is they increasingly came under a view of suspicion. Because they were had dual loyalty in the sense that they were Jews. Until the contest between Zionism, Jewish nationalism, and Palestinian nationalism, Jews lived relatively, not only safely, but relatively happily in North Africa and Arab countries. And in fact, a very good book on that subject by a Jewish scholar by the name of Bernard Lewis is a book called The Jews of Islam, which documents the case, well, which basically studies what Jewish life was like in Islamic Arab countries from the period of the 1500s on. And what he documents is that they led a reasonably good life. Clearly, second class. Second class, that's not, I mean, second class is the word we use. They lived under, what should I say? These were Islamic countries, and they lived in a certain sense, as Christian communities did, in other words, Islam has a view in the Quran that is respectful of Jews and Christians, as the Quran refers to us as people of the book. And indeed, there are parts of the Quran which are quite moving on this, where it says, you know, who is more favorable in the eyes of God, a Jew or a Muslim? And it says, who is more favored is he who is more righteous, which is interesting. In other words, quite an egalitarian look. But there's also another part of Islam which is we're the best. Just as in a certain sense, you know, Christians believe we're better than Jews. Well, Muslims, there's a certain sense that the prophet is the final and the best prophet. Jesus is a prophet, Moses is a prophet, and referred to as such in the Quran. But, so when you had Muslim countries, Jews living there, they lived in a certain sense, you know, comfortably, well, relatively safely, and there was no, but also, you know, they could not be the prime minister. There was nothing in the Jewish experience in Islamic or Arab countries, anything like the Holocaust. Nothing like it, which is interesting. I mean, and Bernard Lewis makes this point very dramatically in his book at a number of points, saying that there is nothing in Islam, in the core teachings of Islam, that's basically anti-Jewish. In the way that in Christian teachings, there are roots deeply embedded in Christian teachings that are anti-Jewish, and that provide a basis for anti-Semitism. And yet, though their experience was good, once Jewish nationalism and Arab nationalism came into this heated up conflict and they became more and more intense, Jews living in Arab countries came under suspicion. They began to feel torn. Where should they be? Should they be here or in Israel? They began to be appealed to by the Jewish nationalist movement to come and support the Zionist struggle. And they began to experience some persecution in their homelands, their Arab countries, or Arab Islamic countries. And large numbers of them fled. They came out of their Arab countries and came to Israel and were part of the tremendous wave of immigrants to Israel that then the state had to deal with. They tended not to be among the earliest immigrants. The earliest immigrants were European, Russian, so forth, but they did come in larger numbers in the 40s. And when Israel was created, the war was created even in larger numbers. And sometimes, in discussions about this, one of the things that said is, well, if Palestinians are going to be compensated for lands or houses they lost in Palestine when Israel was created, should Jews be compensated in some sense for lands they gave up or homes they lost when they left Arab countries? There's not an exact equivalence of the two experiences, but you can imagine why in a discussion about compensation, both of these issues come into the picture. Palestinians and Israelis in one state or two. Well, it is very interesting, though now in some ways water under the bridge part of the history of the conflict, that there were Jews who went to Palestine, who had lived in Palestine for some time, who very strongly took the view that in seeking to establish a Jewish homeland in Palestine, Jews should not establish a Jewish state. There were Jews who took that position. And they took it for a couple of reasons. One kind of reason was a sort of philosophical, religious philosophical reason that had to do with their worry that once Jews established a Jewish state, all the corruptions of stateness or state power would corrupt the very vision of a Jewish homeland and of Jewish values. And of course, in large measure, they're right. You know, I mean, states have a way of corrupting visions and values. They also are ways that humans have found to express visions and values you know, for want of a better way, maybe, but that's the way it's worked. But there were Jews right along that said this. Another reason they took the view was because their fear of what it would mean in terms of relationship with the Arabs. That is, Jews who believed very much in a Jewish homeland, Zionists who believed in a Jewish national homeland, who believed that it was essential to the vision and the practical success of establishing a Jewish homeland that Arabs not suffer from it. And so they opposed creating a Jewish state because they feared, as developments since seem to bear out, that once you got establishing a state, inevitably Arabs would suffer, both in the state and who were not in the state, because of the kind of exclusive character of it. However, those Jews wound up in a minority very clearly by the mid-40s. Martin Buber was one of them. Martin Buber was one of them who took this position. Judah Magnus, the first president of the university, Jerusalem University, was another who took this position. But they wound up in a clear minority, and in part they wound up in a clear minority because of the tremendous pressures of the Holocaust experience and the feelings that Jews developed more strongly as a result of the Holocaust experience, that we need a state of our own. It may in some way, it may have problems with it, but we need state power to protect us, as other peoples have state power to protect them. It also, they became a minority because there was no, on the Arab side, there was not enough of a reciprocal grouping that accepted this idea of some kind, you know, some sort of one state. Palestinians, in the beginning, I mean, after the creation of Israel, the early pre-PLO days, the Palestinian movement essentially said no to the state of Israel and no to Jews remaining who had come after, and I forget what year they chose, it may have been something 1917, in other words, they picked a year and said Jews who were here in Palestine before that can stay, Jews who came after it have to go back. Now that's obviously not even a one-state solution, that's not even accommodationist in that way. As the Palestinian movement evolved over the years, they changed their position, and in the 60s they took the position, the PLO took the position, that they favored a democratic secular state in all of Palestine. Picture the map again, depending on who you are, either it looks like Israel or it looks like Palestine, but it's the same land. And the Palestinian movement said, and came out publicly, officially, and supported the idea of a democratic secular state. That is, all Jews and Palestinians who live, all Jews and non-Jews, they would be Muslims and Christians and Palestinians, who live in this area, form one state, we have a democratic secular government. By that point, and even earlier than the 60s, I mean, Jews were not interested in that. They were interested in a state which had a Jewish character to it, which was not just Jews living in one more democratic secular state, as many Jews would say. We've been there before, you know. We had that in Germany. That was a democratic secular state, and it didn't work. And so there's not much interest on the Jewish side in that idea among most people. The idea of partition, of course, was first raised in this UN, in an official way, in the UN position in 1947. And at the time, and this is very important to understand or to see, to remember that the Jewish national movement accepted the idea of partition in 47, partly because they were getting a homeland out of it. The Palestinian side and the Arab side totally rejected the idea of partition because they felt that any Jewish homeland in this Arab land was robbery. They saw Jews coming from Europe, they saw Western powers supporting the creation of a Jewish homeland, and basically they saw it as a continuation of colonialism. And they have had that for 100 years, you know, or at least most of this century, colonialism, France, Britain, and so forth. So the Arabs said no to partition. And so what you had was a situation until 1988 where the UN is still on record with the idea of partition, two states, an Arab state, now we would say Palestinian state, and a Jewish state, and the Israelis saying, in some sense theoretically we accept the idea of partition, though increasingly, partly with Arab rejection and Israeli increasing what ambitions, they weren't talking about it either. In 1988, In the mid-70s, there's evidence that the Palestinian movement, the PLO, begins to think in the direction of two-state solution in the mid-70s. But it's not till 1988 that the PLO formally adopts the position that says we accept the idea of Israel and of small Palestinian state. Not in that language, but that's what it meant. And as far as
You know, when you look now what's possible, in a certain ideal sense, some people, including some Jews, might still say, well, maybe a democratic state would be the ideal. But I think practically, in terms of these two peoples, that most people would say that if there's going to be a solution that begins to bring these people together, it first has to bring them apart. Because they've been entangled so much in conflict and oppression with the military occupation. So it's oppressor and oppressed, and then the war situation, that there's been so much bad in the interrelationship that in a way you have to pull them apart. Also, their identities are different identities. Their language is different. I mean, there's just a number of very important differences, and then all the bitterness and conflict. So most people say they have to come apart, but I think the people who have some vision and practical sense of what's needed in the future would say, yes, there have to be two entities, two states, but they have to have soft boundaries. Because they're small states, they need each other economically. They need each other in terms of the life of the region. And they can benefit from intercourse with each other and exchange with each other. And in the long run, these borders would even become softer. But for now, there have to be two. I mean, that's I think, the prevailing thinking among circles, both in the Arab side and Palestinian and Israeli side. Ashkenazi Sephardic differences vis-a-vis the conflict. I think one of the things that's been interesting about Israeli history is that, to a large extent, many of us who have related to Israel, including many American Jews, have related to Israel more as a European nation. And this has to do with what makes us comfortable, partly. Nations that are more like us make us more comfortable, and nations are more different. But it also has to do with the fact, for the first 30 years in Israel, the Ashkenazi were the dominant group of Jews in Israel, and they expressed themselves in the Labor Party. If you look at this breakdown of Ashkenazi and Sephardic, remembering Ashkenazi are Jews who came from Europe, Sephardic or Oriental Jews are Jews who came from North Africa and the Middle East. If you look at a breakdown politically, you find that among the Ashkenazi, the European Jews, that doesn't work. Ashkenazi are 65% Labor Party, 35% Likud. And that's wrong, because they're more divided than that. But in terms of the tendencies, labor being somewhat more liberal, somewhat more socialist oriented, or at least welfare state oriented, Likud being more conservative, being more hawkish. Ashkenazi are 65% labor and 35% Likud. The Sephardic are just the opposite. They are 65% Likud and 35% Labor Party. Now that says something about the conflict. It says that, you know, if you assume that a Labor Party in government in Israel is better for the chances of peace, then the Labor Party in power is dependent for the majority of its support on Ashkenazi. But it's got to be complicated a little bit, and at least in a couple of ways. One is that the reason why Sephardic Jews are a majority of them support the Likud, I think it's fairly accepted, has much less to do with their attitude toward the Arabs or the Palestinians, the conflict with the Palestinians, and much more to do with the fact that for the first 30 years in Israel, Ashkenazi Jews from Europe were dominant, were Labor Party. There was a Labor Party government for 30 years, well, 48 to 77, and the Sephardic Jews were viewed in some sense as second-class citizens in Israel. They got the short end of the stick. As Jews now, I'm not talking about the Arab citizens of Israel who get a shorter end of the stick, but they got the shorter end of the stick. For example, one very dramatic way they got the shorter end of the stick. They, as I said, their large numbers of immigrants came somewhat after the European Jews came. So European Jews had sort of, if you will, gotten the good pieces of Israel. And when the Sephardic Jews came, and of course this was a tremendous challenge to the Israeli government in the early years, for all the immigrants, is how do you deal with these tremendous hundreds of thousands of immigrants? You know, it's like if everybody, you know, instead of coming to the United States, you know, over a period of 300 years, in 3 years or 4 years, your country is built out of immigrants. You know, I mean, it's just almost staggering to imagine what the challenges would be for a government to do it. As the Sephardic Jews came in, the Ashkenazi having already been there, the Labor Party in power, the government was building what were called development towns out toward the borders of Israel. And out toward the borders of Israel means near to the borders of guess who? The Arabs. And those were not particularly friendly places. And guess who got put in the development towns? The Sephardic Jews. So if you, for instance, go up to Kiryat Shmona, maybe you've heard of Kiryat Shmona because it's a town on the northern border of Israel, the border with Lebanon, which has been shelled. It's because it's a big town. If you're going to be in Lebanon and aim your katusha somewhere, Kiryat Shmona is a pretty good place to aim it because it's big. If you go to Kiryat Shmona, you find that 75-85% of the people who live in Kiryat Shmona are from Morocco. Well, as you can imagine, as they came and went into these development towns and experienced shelling, for one thing, but also experienced sort of second-class housing, jobs, da-da-da-da-da, they were quite resentful toward the Ashkenazi and toward the Labor Party. And the Likud built its opposition to the Labor Party, which finally won over and came to power in 77, much more, not so much on the issue of the Arabs and Palestinians, but rather much more on we are the outs. We are the outs. The Labor Party is the establishment. And we're challenging the establishment. And they succeeded in 1977 in coming to power. So the question of who's hawkish or who's dovish is complicated by that. That support by the Sephardic Jews for Likud has more to do with economic and social issues than it does with Arab issues. It's complicated in one more way. Some people say the Sephardic Jews who came from the Arab countries and North Africa are bitter at the Arab countries because of their bad experience there. And they don't trust them even more than European Jews don't trust them, trust Arabs. Other people say because they came from Arab countries and they speak Arabic, they have a cultural affinity with Arabs, they in a certain sense, the Sephardic Jews, can be a bridge to the Arab countries. And if you ask me which is true, I think both are, which is messy, but I think that's the reality. And so when you talk with Sephardic Jews, you get a mixed thing about it. I mean, it's not clear. One sense of how that might be reconciled is that if peace really begins to happen, the Sephardic Jews could well become more of a bridge than they are an obstacle to peace. In part because of language, in part because of cultural affinity. I think I told a story in one of the other sessions about when Sadat came to Jerusalem. That, in, for instance, it was in Kiryat Shmona that we heard this story. That people in Kiryat Shmona, just the woman we were talking to, was happened to be a community organizer, very hawkish in some ways. I mean, support, well, hawkish. She was support, strong Likud supporter. In fact, she was a party organizer. And I'll tell one little more story about it, which helps to complicate this a little bit, but what she said is when Sadat came, she was riding on a bus, and all the people, when they heard that Sadat was coming to Jerusalem, they all cheered. Now, these are Moroccan Jews from Morocco, and they're hawkish. Begin and Shamir opposed the Camp David peace treaty, but these people reacted very positively to Sadat coming. And part of it, I would suggest, has to do with the fact that these are people who, in a peace settlement, can reconcile their two homelands. Their new homeland in Israel with their old homeland, centuries old, in the various Arab countries. We come across the Jordan River from Amman to the West Bank and go up to Jerusalem, and we met Israeli soldiers, and I'll never forget a conversation with an Israeli woman soldier who she saw we were carrying copper. She said, oh, where'd you get that? Looks like it might come from Yemen. Did it come from Yemen? We said, no, but why are you interested in Yemen? Well, that's where I'm from, and do you go to Yemen? And, oh, I want to go to Yemen. So my mother tells me stories about Yemen. Well, it's an Israeli soldier, you know, who's supposed to be ready to fight the Arabs at any moment, but she's very interested in Yemen because her mother's from Yemen. And what I'm saying is, if the peace thing actually begins to move, I think Jews from Arab countries could become, in a business sense, in a cultural sense, in a variety of ways, possible help to that peace process.
What are the proportions now?
Oh, that's, I said that the other day. Right now, majority of Israeli Jews are Sephardic. Part of that's higher birth rates than the Ashkenazi, European Jews. Right now, I think it's at least 55% Sephardic to 45% Ashkenazi. And some shift in terms of the party identification. This is a kind of sort of stock and trade division, and I can't get it finer than that. It'd be interesting to know in this last election whether this percentage, did Labour Party win any more Likud seats? I mean, Likud support. Labour Party has been trying to put in some Sephardic Jews in places in their list, in their political, when they run for the Knesset. put some figures, people who are known in the Sephardic community, in their list to try to attract more. One of the reasons that Abba Ibn was pushed out of the Labour Party list, it's speculated anyway, is that Abba Ibn is so European in his sound and manner that he's almost offensive to Sephardic Jews. I mean, he comes across as arrogant, like, you know, in the way that we were talking last night about racism in the forum. That just the way he talks, you know, he may say very wise things, but in a way he sounds like he's arrogant. And of course, he's not European, he's South African. Abba Ibn, his background is Abba Ibn. But he was pushed out of the Labour Party. Some people said his party, as a symbol to the Sephardic Jews, that, you know, we're getting new leadership and blah, blah, blah. I think it was also fights between he and other leaders. Christians talking with Jews, any cautions or advice? It is hard. It's hard. And I guess that's the first thing, the most important piece of advice, to know that it's hard and to try to understand why it is. I think the worst mistake that a Christian can make is to sort of boldly walk into the issue and say, you know, why can't you just do this and you just do that? In other words, think that we have the answers. I'll give you a dramatic illustration of this. An American ambassador in the early 50s is quoted as saying, I don't understand why the Arabs and Jews don't make peace in the way good Christians would. Now, none of you will do that, but I think, you know, I said some session, maybe it was yesterday, that we Christians forget more easily than Jews or Muslims do our history with them, and it's not surprising that they remember because they've suffered it. Jews have suffered their history with us to a large extent, you know? I mean, it isn't a pleasant history, including Martin Luther. You know, you read some of the things Martin Luther said about Jews, and my God, you know, you have to begin with an apology to any Jew when you say, I'm a Lutheran. And then with Muslims, the Crusades, you know? And also the stereotypes of Muslims and Arabs. So you begin the conversation begin the conversation with Jews, having to appreciate that there's a lot of sensitivity probably there, a lot of sort of nervousness there of what's gonna come. One of the simplest points about that to help us understand it is, as some of you may know, Jewish opinion on this issue of what to do in this country, Jewish opinion in this country, is very divided. And in fact, every poll that's been taken in the last 5-8 years indicates that a majority of Jewish opinion supports the right of Palestinians to self-determination and even a Palestinian state. One of the most dramatic recent polls, just when Shamir was about to arrive, it was released by an American Jewish peace group to embarrass Shamir, was that they did a poll of something like 368 leaders of the Jewish Federation around the country, so key leadership people. And they found that 68% supported the right of Palestinians to a state of their own, an independent state, as long as it didn't endanger the security of Israel. Now, I think that statistic comes as somewhat of a surprise to many American Christians. Well, two things come as a surprise. One is that there's a lot of division in the Jewish community. And two, that the division goes this direction, in a hopeful direction. And then the question is, well, why don't we know about that? Well, the fact is that in terms of organized Jewish community expression, there's much more conservative view. And much more attempt at least faking unanimity. Why is that? Well, it has to do with the simple fact that Jews are willing among themselves to argue about these issues. But they're very reticent to expose their arguments to the non-Jewish community because they're afraid of what we might do with them. Might do with them meaning we might use them in ways that could undermine the safety of Israel. Because they don't trust us in that sense. Now you say, I mean, someone said yesterday, $5 billion in aid to Israel. They don't trust us. That's right, $5 billion to aid, and they don't trust us. There's a disconnection between the amount of aid and the feelings of Jews toward can they count on us in a way of support. So in terms of conversations, I think you have to approach it with a certain sense that. I want to hear some of the things you're thinking about. I understand there is discussion in the Jewish community. Could you tell me a little bit about different views there? I mean, it's at least in the beginning, it's more listening than talking. And finding out what the trigger points are. Begin a conversation with, well, don't you think we should pressure Israel to make compromises, maybe cut aid to Israel? That's a pressure point. That's likely to get a fairly strong response and maybe shut down the conversation, you know? In a similar way to the way in talking with an Arab American, a Palestinian American, if you say, you know, well, why do the Palestinians follow the PLO? And PLO is such terrorists. That's likely to be a real sharp point. That'll cause real defense. Because just as for Jews, there's a sense that they can't quite count on us. They don't know where we are. For Palestinians, there's real sensitivity about the stereotypes of the PLO as terrorists. PLO, Palestinian terrorists. You know, I remember talking. A rabbi and a Palestinian teacher, actually in Seattle, had lunch with a whole bunch of Jews, Christians, Muslims one day. And after the meeting, the rabbi, who's a guy who wants to do it, you know, he wants to do it. I mean, he's for a compromise, he's for something, but he's nervous. He's nervous himself. He's nervous, but then he's nervous in his community. You know, and he doesn't want to be too far out of the way. And so he turns to this Palestinian fellow and he says, you know, he says, I'm so impressed, so moved with what you said. I'm so glad to meet you. I've never really met a Palestinian American before. But let me ask you one question before I go home, before I leave. He said, are you PLO? And the Palestinian scholar, teacher at UW said, you mean am I Palestinian? And the rabbi says, no, I know you're Palestinian. Smiling still, you know, and says, are you PLO? Palestinian says, you mean am I Palestinian? You know, goes on a couple times and then the rabbi gets it. You know, and he says, oh, you mean, he said, but basically if you're Palestinian, you're PLO. And the Palestinian scholar said, that's it, you got it now. And the rabbi said, oh man, he says, I'm glad I asked you that question. I'm glad you told me that, he said. That's going to make my work back in my congregation a lot harder, but I'm glad I know it now. Well, that's interesting. See, he wanted to have it in a way that he could more safely take it back, you know, to his congregation, but it didn't work. It didn't work. I have an article. If some of you, for some of you who are not coming, I have a brief version of a longer article, which, interesting, has now appeared in Jewish, Christian, and Muslim publications. I guess I don't have it with me. I have it upstairs. It's in the office, but I'll get it if anybody wants it. It's an article which just outlines some of the issues for Jews, American Jews, in dealing with this issue in an interfaith way, for American Muslims dealing with this, and for American Christians. And you might want to take a look at that. Are there any other questions before we say at least a word or two about here we are, U.S. policy? Well, let me just say just a couple things and we'll break, because 5 o'clock's dinner. I think, I don't know how you feel about this, I'll say how I feel about it, and my sense is a lot of people share this. I wish the Arabs and the Israelis and the Palestinians could make peace without any help from the U.S. It'd be a lot sounder, safer, piece of integrity of their own. And in a certain sense, that's what peace in the Middle East has to be. It has to be their own. And in that sense, it cannot be packaged on the outside and pushed in. It's got to be theirs. Despite our tremendous power, they have so much at stake, as do, say, Bosnians and Serbs and Croats, you know, that you just can't package it and plop it down. It's got to be theirs. And if they could do it on their own without help from us, I would say, as an American, boy, I'm glad about that, you know. Whew. I mean, one of the things, as an American, you must sometimes feel, you know, is like, why? Wouldn't it be wonderful if we didn't have so much power? You know? I don't mean that we do it, that we do because we do bad with it only, but because we have to do something with it, you know? We got it, however. And the fact of the matter is that anybody who says that there's going to be peace between Israel, the Palestinians, and the Arab states without a U.S. role.